Yes, more energy. Who's ready? Yes, 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 yes. And what are we here for, right? What do we really want? We want to learn, but why do we want to learn?
Change lives.
Thank you. We want to change lives, right? So let's just, all the energy you have, just throw your hands up and say, let's change some lives.
Let's change some lives.
Woo! Yes, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. All right. So let's get into a little bit more about nutritional endocrinology and the way that our food and our thoughts and everything else affects our hormones and how we can help our clients to change that. And you know, this whole concept of nutritional endocrinology, we are in the infancy stage with this. And I see this as we move forward in the future, like some of the things that nobody'd ever heard of before and now are like commonplace words, right? That everybody says, oh yeah, who's your family doctor? You have a family doctor, right? Everybody has a family doctor. That's expected, right? Who's your nutritional endocrinology practitioner? What are you doing with, you know, your diet? And who counsels you on that, that everybody will just expect to have one, right? And we're in the infancy stage. So I'm excited about it. I'm excited about it. So let's talk about families. Who has a family? Everybody has a family? And we know that sometimes the relationships in families are super harmonious. Is that all the time? And what happens when it is harmonious? Like, it's wow, right? But when it gets out of balance, it ain't so pretty, right? Same in your body. You have families of hormones in your body. And when they're working and they're in harmony and they're communicating the way they need to, man, your body's humming. Everything's working. And when they get out of balance and there's some disharmony there and some of them are fighting, we're going to talk about how hormones fight. Did anybody know that hormones fight? There's hormones that fight. Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that. And we're going to talk about how to get them to stop fighting. So what are the hormone families? So we had that big chart, remember, before that had, what, 87 different hormones on it? I said, I want you to memorize that by the end of the week. No, I want you to memorize these seven families by the end of the weekend and really get a feel for what these families are. And then once you think about a family, you say, oh, okay, that family includes these hormones. And you'll be thinking as you're speaking to people, like, which are the families that are fighting right now? Which is the first family I need to get in harmony? So we have metabolic rate. What is metabolic rate? Anybody? Metabolic rate. The way that your rate at which your body's actually burning oxygen and sugar to create energy, right? And each cell has a metabolic rate, and there are hormones that control that. Anybody want to shout out what those hormones are? What some of those are? Thyroid is a biggie in metabolic rate. So we have thyroid hormones in there, but also it's controlled by other things. And we'll look at the family chart, but it's very much controlled by level of stress. So cortisol affects your metabolic rate. Insulin and glucagon, because they affect the amount of sugar in your blood, that's going to affect the metabolic rate. Your lungs are going to affect the metabolic rate, right? Because you have to get oxygen in there to be able to burn it for fuel. And then, of course, there's all the nutrients that go into that. So that's the metabolic rate family. We've got the blood sugar balancing family. No matter how good your metabolic rate hormones are humming along, if your sugar is not available to the cells to burn, it ain't going to happen. Okay, so getting the blood sugar balanced and the blood sugar into those cells so that then you can create energy, super, super important. What are some of the blood sugar balancing hormones? Insulin, leptin, glucagon. Yep, those are some of those. Great. Appetite and digestion. We mentioned that earlier. Most people don't think about hormones relating to digestion. So some of the hormones that are outside of the digestive tract that affect it are cortisol, big time effect on digestion. People, when they're under stress, their gut is a mess. Insulin and glucagon, the whole blood sugar balance affects the digestion. And then there's those hormones within the digestive tract that help with the secretion of the stomach acid, the secretion of the pancreatic fluids, the bile flow. They're all controlled by hormones. And it's really important to get that under control. And they sometimes fight. And actually, there are hormones whose jobs are the complete opposite of other hormones. So there's going to naturally be a fight. Sometimes that fight is what we need to, because we need to turn off the stomach acid now so that you can digest and absorb. Because if you kept producing too much stomach acid, then you end up destroying the mucous membrane of your gut. So the fighting, some of that fighting is important, and maybe it's not so much fighting, it's, let's just call it tempering. You're going to calm you down, you're done, let's move on. And some exciting stuff in that that I want to share with you that is probably you've never heard before. Stress. What are some of the stress hormones? Cortisol, adrenaline, norepinephrine, pregnenolone, DHEA. There's a whole bunch of them related to stress. And the increase in the stress response of sympathetic versus parasympathetic. So big influence in the stress hormones and the nervous system, right? Parasympathetic nervous system is that calm state. That's when you learn best. And speaking of which, I skipped something that I was going to do. We're going to all get into, after our breaks, we're going to get ourselves into parasympathetic state. And we can do that in 30 seconds if we're good, a minute or two if we're learning. How's that sound? Okay? Most of you have seen this before or heard this before. So I want you, everybody, to just get comfortable in your chair. And you can always do this with your eyes open, but I always like to practice it with the eyes closed. Just put your right hand over your heart, your left hand over your belly, just to focus in. And you're focusing your attention on your heart. Take a few long, slow, deep breaths and breathe as if you're breathing right into your heart. And then on the next breath in, I want you to breathe in appreciation for something, some person, place, thing, place. I appreciate the beach. And I just go to the beach. And I bring that feeling that I have when I'm at the beach. I just feel myself. I don't see myself. I feel myself. I had to realize I'm not a visualizer. I'm a feelerizer. So breathe that place in. And feel it in your body. Just be there. Be hugging that pet or putting your feet into the ocean. And then close it out with one or two more deep breaths and allow that feeling to just permeate through your body. And when you're ready, just let your hands drop down and then open your eyes. Doesn't that feel good? Does it feel different than before you started? So we'll just start after each break. I'll just say, okay. And that, in heart math terms, that's called quick coherence. It's a great tool to teach your clients. Because if you learn how to shift out of sympathetic state, sympathetic is that fight-flight state, and you're driving along on the highway and you see somebody that's about to cut you off, it's natural to go into that state. And it could take hours for the effects of that to go away if you don't teach them these methods of stopping it and shifting into what's called parasympathetic. And especially if you have them into that sympathetic right before they eat, now we're talking about the connection between digestion and the stress, you can't digest because everything gets turned off. We don't get the secretion of all those juices to help us digest. You get contraction, constipation, things like that can result. So teaching people this simple little thing. Sound good? Good? Okay. All right, so we have stress. We have the sex hormones. And typically when you say to somebody, I help people balance their hormones, this is what they're thinking, right? They're thinking sex hormones. Everybody's, their minds are always in the bedroom, right? Oh, hormones, bed, right? But that's just part of it. And a lot of practitioners who specialize in sex hormones and reproductive hormones, they start there. So they go in and they say, oh, you've got, oh, let's just run an estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, see what those levels are, and give you some hormones for that. But it really all starts way before that, right? Metabolic rate affects everything. And if the metabolic rate is low, with it, ovaries, testes, adrenals, they're going to be low. They're not going to be producing as well as they could. Stress, we'll see the connection between stress, because they have all the same precursors. And we'll show you that chart later. They have all the same precursors. So if you're stressed, your body's not going to be making estrogen, testosterone, and progesterone. And you're going to mess up your reproductive cycle and your sex drive. Who here has worked with somebody who said their sex drive was diminished? Yeah, very common, because that's, if tigers are chasing you and you're thinking about having sex, you're in trouble, right? You're not going to live to tell about it. So it's a natural protective mechanism for the sex drive to get turned off. We need to help our clients to turn it back on. And just that simple thing I just did with you is a great way to start. And there's lots of others. Some of you might be meditation teachers or yoga teachers. There's lots of ways. I personally, this is one I gravitate to, because I could do it in a minute. I could do it in 30 seconds, and I can do it all day long. Whereas with meditation, I take longer, and I have to clear my mind, and I don't feel like I'm doing it, and then I'm stressed because I can't meditate. And I'm like, I'm stressed out. I can't meditate. I can't. Okay, heart math. How many of you have been on calls with me where something went wrong and, you know, technology was failing? And I was like, okay, let's just, I'm at the beach. How was your day? I went to the beach a lot today. Everybody knows. What does that mean? I had a stressful day. But I can keep it calm. My husband was freaking out about something that I could have been freaking out about. And he's like, how are you going to handle that? What are you going to do? I'm like, It takes a lot of time. So if you want to start with one tool that you can teach people, start now. Because it took me years to get to the point where I could just, at will, go there. How many times did I want to just do inexplicable things to that kid that was driving me crazy? And there, you know, kids just do that to get your goat, right? But do your heart math. But he deserves me to be mad at him. And then you get to the point where, okay, the situation may deserve you to get that way, but it's not serving you to do it. And that's the message to get across to your clients and to you. And when you're scared because that person just mailed you the stack of labs this tall and they've been to 5 other practitioners before you and you're sitting there going, do your heart math. Calm yourself down and know that you have what it takes. And if you don't have what it takes, you know the resources you can get for them or people that you can send them to. You're not going to just send them off to a gastroenterologist. You're going to find somebody who you really know that understands. So sex and reproduction, sleep, thoughts, and emotions. I have a module in my Before Be Gone program called The Hormones That Dance in Your Sleep. And it's amazing what's happening hormonally during sleep. Huge. You've got... There's this interplay between a lot of these other families. There's glucagon and cortisol growth hormone and leptin and estrogen, progesterone, melatonin. So melatonin is what we think of as the main sleep hormone. But there's all these others. And if those are out of balance, you ain't going to sleep. If you've got cortisol surging through your bloodstream right before you're going to go to bed, sleep isn't going to happen. Because it's the alert hormone. It's getting you prepared to run away. So we want to learn ways to understand. And the interplay with sleep, thoughts, emotions, and the neurotransmitters. That's huge too. And when you understand how they fit together, you're able to do this. So finally, there's others that we won't go into much this weekend because we could be here in a course of endocrinology. It could take 2 or 3 years. But with organ functions, There's hormones affecting the kidney. There's hormones affecting that's secreted by the heart. Do you know that your heart secretes hormones? Did anybody ever think about the heart as an endocrine gland? It's the eighth one. Yeah. Okay, so I have a little chart. This afternoon we'll go into more detail, and I have these really cool charts for each of these families. And you'll get to see what those are, and I just put a few of them on that chart. But there's heart, kidneys, secretes hormones, controls kidney function. Some of them control the blood vessels, so the heart will secrete something that controls the vasodilation. So there's all this stuff. Do you have to understand and know all that? No. But knowing that that exists, right, that the heart is actually part of the endocrine system, as well as the kidneys. So there's family of organ functions. So these are the main ones. And what I find, and this is pretty close to hierarchical order, it's going to change from one person to the next a little bit. And that's where some of the clinical assessment tools that we talk about tomorrow will help you. But basically, if your metabolic rate is screwed and your digestion is screwed and you're under stress and you can't keep your blood sugar met, these top four are the most important ones. So even if somebody's complaining about hot flashes and or they're complaining about some other issues in other organs, it's you got to get these four. You got to get these four balanced first. And then after that, you know what happens usually? The problems went away. And we're going to talk about tomorrow in assessments, the assessments you can use and how frequently to redo some of the assessments so you can see. And I've got some scorecards that you'll get that you have in your packet out there that you can use with your clients to go, you know what, we don't want to spend $150 to rerun that lab test. Let's just see. And you go, whoa, your numbers went way down. Or are you really taking that thing that I, are you really going off that thing? And you go, because it's not showing. And if they are doing all the things you said, then it's time to reevaluate and change the plan. And if that they're not, well, I do it sometimes. Well, yeah, three times a week I do whatever. Okay, we see that the difference isn't happening. We need to evaluate that. So it's, but I really find that by the time you get to, okay, let's focus on these specific organs, it so much of it is gone. Whereas if you just start with where they're complaining about their problem. Oh, they're complaining about joint pain. So let's just go to, let's just understand their joint function and do that. Then it, that's not going to fix. You got to fix all those things. Okay? And stress, there's a huge connection between stress and joint pain. Does anybody understand that connection? Who anybody want to share that? Okay? No? It's inflammation-based and the adrenal fatigue is affects the ligaments. When somebody's in adrenal fatigue, they have serious ligament laxity, right? And inflammation, you're totally right. And inflammation's part of all of this, right? Yeah, but it's that ligament laxity that's caused by the adrenal stress as well. So if you're working on getting them, you know, they can't get their muscles and their joints and all that, maybe their adrenals are whacked out. We need to work on that as well. Right. So let's look at our hormone families. And this is on your next page that you're going to see. It has all kinds of arrows on it. So it looks kind of, so I'm going to one by one put the arrows in because this is the relationships between them. And it's important for you to understand the relationships between them. Otherwise, you're just going to be grasping at straws. So stress and sleep. That's pretty clear, right? If you're stressed out and your mind is going a mile a minute, you're producing cortisol. It's going to keep you from sleeping. If you're stressed and doing stress eating, that late night snacking, that's going to affect sleep because it thwarts the growth hormone spike that happens within the first hour of sleep. Okay, and that helps you to sleep better and deeper. It affects leptin levels. So everything about stress can affect sleep. The high levels of adrenaline that get produced. It's, you know, when you go on a roller coaster, right? It really feels great. That's adrenaline. That's an adrenaline rush. And it goes up there, sympathetic response goes back down, you're fine, right? But if you were on a roller coaster all day long, that would whack out your system, right? It takes so much resource to do that, and you end up in adrenal fatigue. So the good stresses, the high sympathetic responses, have a problem too. And I'll share tomorrow a chart that you can just draw with your clients. It's fun to just draw it with them and sit there and say, okay, draw a line here and here, and we're going to just plot your emotions, and let's see where your emotions lie and how we can shift some of that so we can shift that. The way that your body responds. So there's the stress and the appetite. We talked about that before, right? That cortisol shuts down the digestive tract because running away from tigers and eating are not things that you want to do at the same time. You want to avoid being lunch. You don't want to stop and eat lunch when a tiger is chasing you. So stress and appetite, and they are, it's a two-way street. right? So some of the hormones that are produced in the digestive tract and some of the infections and inflammation that are in the digestive tract as a result of poor eating habits and exposures, that's a stress on the system. And one thing that's really important to realize, and we'll go through more of this, I'm just giving you like overviews of stuff and then we're gonna hone in deeper. But when you, so when we look at stress, right, we think about stress being, okay, emotional stress, financial stress, relationship stress, all that. But we have to be looking in our clients for other sources of stress, physiologic stresses. And hidden gut infections are very, very common. So many people have those. Sources of inflammation in the body. And so if you've got some of that going on, or if you have somebody that's eating on the run and they're not producing enough enzymes, they've got all this undigested debris in their gut, that's going to create a stress. So that's the interaction there. So the next one we have is blood sugar, right? That's big time. And there's actually some hormones in your digestive tract that work to stimulate the release of insulin even before the blood sugar hits, the sugar hits the blood. And we'll talk about that one later when we show you that chart. So there's a huge, and when your blood sugar goes down, right, and it triggers that you have low blood sugar, what happens? You want to eat more. The big hormones in the appetite that most people don't know about, but you're a sophisticated audience, so I've heard that popped out there before, leptin, right? Leptin imbalances and leptin resistance. And leptin is produced by what? Who produces leptin? Anybody know? Fat cells. Leptin's produced by fat cells. So your fat cells are an endocrine organ. Go figure. So they produce leptin to say, okay, done, we're full. So people, the first question people ask me is, well, look at me. Why am I hungry all the time? If I have all these fat cells and they're signaling leptin to say I'm full, why am I hungry all the time? Well, remember we talked about those receptors? Leptin resistance, very common. Right, so people think, oh, I just need higher levels of leptin. No, you got so many fat cells, they're producing a lot of leptin. Your hypothalamus, which is where the receptors are, and your pancreas, which is where there's also receptors for leptin, they just put their hands over the ears. This is the way I describe receptors. Little kid, hands over ears. Mommy's yelling at me again. I have no idea what she's saying. And I don't care. I just want to shut it out. I'm just going to go crawl in a hole. That's what your cell receptors do. It's like I'm bombarded with all this insulin or all this leptin. It just turns off, and then the signals don't happen. So if you get nothing out of this weekend, hormone resistance is huge. It's a huge thing, and understanding how to keep the hormone resistance from happening, okay? What's next? Blood sugar, insulin. Yeah, sleep and organ-specific functions, right? If you don't get enough sleep, then your body doesn't repair. You don't have all that great detox repair going on. It's very common. Deficiencies of melatonin, which is a sleep hormone, can lead to cancer. So if you've got somebody who's had cancer and they're not sleeping and they're saying, oh, I just stay up all night, I do this. No, sleep is super important. If they've got their cortisol levels up at night or they're eating late at night and they're doing things to stress themselves out and then they're not sleeping, they're predisposing them to higher risk of cancer. So very specific, and any organs that don't get cleansed, the next day they're going to be sluggish because they're just full of toxins. You know, it's food in, toxins out, food in, toxins out, food in, toxins out, for eat on a cellular level. Same way your digestive tract works, right? Food in, the debris goes out. Same thing in the cells. And when that doesn't happen because there's not enough sleep, sleep affects all of these. You're going to see an arrow from sleep to all of these. And I may have missed some arrows. I just, you know, there's just so much you can put on one slide and before it gets unreadable. Okay? So the organ-specific with the blood sugar, with the metabolic rate. Now, again, the metabolic rate affects everything. If you have low metabolic rate, low cellular energy, it's going to affect all of it. And then the blood sugar and the metabolic rate. And back again. And reproduction and metabolic rate, right? Thyroid problems can lead to infertility problems. That's even established. The medical profession goes, oh yeah, let's test the thyroid. But what they don't do is understand that there's the 22 patterns of dysfunction that they ought to be looking at. And oh, well, it mustn't be your thyroid. Well, it could be your thyroid. So it's very, very important to understand that reproduction is affected, and reproduction is affected by the sleep. Again, not enough sleep. Your hormones are out of whack. Estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. Deficiencies of progesterone can cause you not to be able to fall asleep. Some people, if that's the case, they have a deficiency of progesterone, give them liquid progesterone right before they go to sleep, and they sleep like a baby. Okay, other people, you might give progesterone at sleep and it doesn't do anything. Does that mean that progesterone doesn't work for sleep? No, it means that that person didn't have a deficiency of progesterone. And that's the beauty of functional medicine and nutritional medicine, is that, and that's why the standard medical establishment will say, oh, that doesn't work. I gave my patient this vitamin C and it didn't work. It's everybody's going to be different. What's the nutrient deficiency that we're working here? What's the hormone deficiency we're working on here? And it may be different, right? When I had the headaches, they're like, oh, it's a Valium deficiency. Well, I didn't have a Valium deficiency. How long will I have to take this Valium? Oh, as long as you have stress in your life, you just keep taking the Valium. Like, okay, right? We don't have Valium deficiencies. We don't have Prozac deficiencies. We don't have Pepcid AD deficiencies. We have imbalance in the organ systems. And when we understand how it all works and how we can assess it, then we're going to be able to tell people what to do, like this person who came in and it was blood sugar. Does everybody that joins Before Be Gone have that same response? No. For her, her endocrine disruption had tremendous amount to do with the blood sugar imbalance and the excess weight, because she focused on that and everything went away. I wish that was true of everybody, because it would be great. I'd have thousands and millions of people every day wanting to do that program with me. But it's all a matter of finding it. Everybody has a different way. And when you understand this, it'll come to you. The more you delve yourself into this, you're sitting there talking to somebody, you go, oh, I'm going to look at this and that and the other thing. What have they looked at already? Oh, nobody's looked at the melatonin and the sleep and the fact that she's eating bonbons an hour before she goes to bed while she watches TV, or popcorn. It doesn't have to be bonbons. People say, well, what about popcorn? Carb. When we talk about blood sugar later, we'll talk about more about that. But that, any of that stuff, right? It's getting them out of that habit. So sleep and reproduction, and okay, you just see, it just all goes. Okay, let's go back. You'll see, that's what you have in there. There could be way more arrows in there, but they're all interconnected. And when we can untangle the web of the interconnections and try to find what's at the heart of it, what's one or two of the core ones? Because what I see a lot, and you probably see this too, people come in with their shopping bag full of supplements they're taking. They're like, well, I read this thing online, and then I read David Brownstein's book, and then I read so-and-so's book, and I figured that must be my problem, and now I'm taking all these 47 different nutrients, and I don't think this nutritional medicine is working for me. Like, I'm just throwing the towel. Well, throw away most of your stuff. And I've done that with people. Let's just throw all of it to the side and let's start with one. I had one person come in. She was taking like $300 a month worth of supplements. And she had this issue with her blood pressure. And her blood pressure was going up. She goes, the blood pressure is not going down. And now I'm having this and I'm looking at it. She was taking 42 a day of an antiparasitic herb. Because somebody muscle tested her and said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, oh, 43? Okay, you need 42. I'm like, okay, I love muscle testing. It can be used as an integrative approach, but not as the be-all and the end-all, right? I mean, it doesn't make sense. I took her off all her stuff. I put her on one or two things. I did a few dietary things, and within a week, she was way better. So that's the thing too. So when people come in and they're on a gazillion things, sometimes you got to take them off of it. Sometimes it's just, and they're interacting with each other. And the body, can you imagine how confused your body gets? Like, food has a bunch of different nutrients in it. But when you just take all this stuff that doesn't really occur in nature together and you're taking 42 things at the same time, how confused can your body get? Oh, you want me to upregulate the metabolism. Oh, you want me to decrease the metabolism. You want to increase the blood sugar. Now you're telling me you want me to So no wonder they're not having problems. So sometimes you have to just take them off of everything and then put them back on. Being careful that you don't take them off the 5-HTP and the vitamin B6 because they said that before they took it, they were suicidal, and now they're not. So that's where thorough history comes in, right? So it's thorough history, right? Oh, yeah, just take all the supplements away and put them on a detox. You want to get into big trouble? You got to be careful. Even simple thing like, oh, yeah, everybody needs detox. You do it in a way that's going to support them thoroughly, right? There's some people that don't do well doing a fast or a cleanse or a juice cleanse. But they might be able to if you support them in other ways. And that's what we want to learn. That's why you want to learn the basics. So I wanted to throw in that hormones are in the news all the time. You're going to read stuff. So it's not just about, okay, we studied this and it's in the textbook and we read what's in the textbook and we know everything about hormones. I don't know everything about hormones. So if you had that impression, just, you know, throw it away. Nobody knows everything there is. And there's constantly new stuff coming out and being in the news. So I picked four different things that I thought were quite interesting that have happened over the last few months. And pregnenolone blocks the marijuana high. Pregnenolone is a hormone secreted by the adrenals. It's the precursor to all the steroid hormones. So pregnenolone goes down to progesterone, DHEA, estrogen, testosterone, cortisol, and it can block the marijuana high. So if somebody's taking marijuana therapeutically, it's basically what they're saying is that it blocks the activity of, guess what, a receptor. The cannabinoid receptor in the brain so that they can get the benefits like the pain relieving or the glaucoma, because there's a lot of use of medical marijuana, but somebody's taking medical marijuana and they're going to work high. I mean, that's kind of weird. So they can get the benefits of that, right? So kind of interesting. Pregnenolone and marijuana. Who'd have thought, right? I didn't know that. So the hormones in the BRCA gene, the hormones that the BRCA is that breast cancer risk gene that was in the news big time last year when Angelina Jolie found out she had the BRCA gene and decided to cut off her breasts. Who thinks that was a good idea? Like, didn't anybody talk to her about nutrition and prevention? Oh, you have a high risk for that. Let's talk about get off the Twinkies, get some good sleep, eat some great. There's a lot of stuff that she could have done, but she cut off her breasts. Well, here's the study. Like, of course, we knew this, that people that have it, it's because of their diet that they express it. And there's specific nutrients that will help them to either express it or not express it. So don't cut off your breasts. What is she going to cut off her brain because she found out she had a brain cancer gene? I mean, it doesn't make sense, right? And it's accepted by the public to say, oh, poor thing, but she's so brave. Did anybody hear somebody say that? She's so brave. Like, come on. Like, Venus had a breast cancer. She actually had it. She overcame it. How'd she do it? A lot of hard work, a lot of research, and completely changing her diet and lifestyle, okay? And her attitude and her thoughts, right? So we have to really, if there's one thing you can do for your clients more than anything, is to share with them the value and the importance of making changes. That, look, this is what the lifestyle did that led you here. Are you willing to continue that lifestyle and cut off the diseased part? Because if that's what you want to do, the next disease part, and then you're just, what do you have left? Right? So we can't just cut out the diseased part. We can't just treat the diseased part. We have to understand all of this. So voila, cruciferous vegetables, who'd have thunk, right? So lots of things like that. It's not just cruciferous vegetables. There's others. And Michaeline's going to show us some really cool genetic pathways that we'll share with you some other things in the methylation and why some people are prone to certain things and why other people aren't. And when she gets to her talk, I'll share a little bit about my genes. And people think, oh, you're so lucky. You stay so thin. And da, da, da. You must have good genes. not, which is really encouraging, really encouraging. My genes are bad, but I feel great in my 50s. Why? Because I decided in my 20s that I was going to change how I thought, how I ate. I was changed everything. And your clients can get better too. And I have, like the woman I told you about earlier, 65 years old. She'd been told, you'll never get over this. You'll never lose the weight. You're too old. You've never going to, you can't move your hip. You're never, never, never. She was 65. She made some changes and now. So it's not too late. It just takes maybe a little bit more doing, and it's understanding. So obese kids have higher levels of cortisol than non-obese kids. And we talk about cortisol, we talk about, oh, cortisol can lead you to belly fat, right? Well, they're finding that. I think obese kids have higher levels of cortisol than non-obese. And there's a study from these researchers in, where was this one? The Netherlands. It's a small study, but I think if it was a larger study, they would find out, quite frankly, that it's true across the board. And obese adults probably have higher levels of cortisol. Well, by the time they get to be adults, they probably have lower levels of cortisol because they've burned out their adrenals and now they're not producing it. But they have spikes of cortisol. Still, they're just going, okay, give me that cortisol. And he goes, okay, we'll get you away from the tiger. Ugh. And then they're mostly flatlined throughout the day. So, but that's, it's obvious. So the stuff that we're, and there's a link for that. It's obvious the stuff that we're talking about is really critical and it's in the news. And this is the last one. It's a cool one. Oxytocin. We know oxytocin is when you touch, it's the milk letdown hormone. So when women are nursing a baby, they feel the baby in their arms, you know, and it gives you that feeling of euphoria. Oxytocin, if anybody has a deficiency in oxytocin and they say, should I take oxytocin? No, just go have sex. Orgasm, best way to get oxytocin levels up. So if you have, you want to go talk to your partner and say, can I get some oxytocin boost today? My oxytocin levels are high. But the good news is it doesn't have to be just sex. It's touch and massage, right? I had a massage the other day. Gretchen came over and gave me a massage. And I just felt like I was so blissed out after that massage. And my brain was so clear that I was able to shoot through all the rest of the stuff that I had to do. And it's like, so taking that break, hug breaks, right? Stroking your children. I say my younger son, he's like always going for oxytocin boosts, even at age 15. He's like, oh, mama, give me a hug. I want to cuddle with you. If anybody has kids, you know that at that age, they never want to, but it's like he's driven by oxytocin, this child, right? Well, they're finding that oxytocin actually helps men to be a monogamous. Go figure. And they did this study where they showed them pictures of attractive women, one including their wife. And you know how men get after a while. It's like, well, that other one looks a little cuter than her. And they measure the arousal in the brain. When they gave them a boost of oxytocin, I think they gave them a nasal boost of oxytocin, their wife looked like the most attractive one on the page even when she wasn't. Okay? The power of hormones to keep your guy faithful, okay? Pretty cool, right? So as you sneak up on them and you start rubbing their back, and same thing with, you know, with kids, with everybody, right? It's the oxytocin is pretty amazing. So these are just some fun things I thought just to give you an idea of why it's important to learn hormones. There's the study. All right. So, as you can tell now, just about every symptom that you can think of can be hormone-related. Just about everything, right? All the stuff up here, fatigues, digestive problems. Anybody have an idea of one that you think may not be hormone-related? Throw it out if you do. We'll see if we can. Fatigue, weight gain. The people that come in and say, look, I'm doing this. I'm eating a 300-calorie-a-day diet. I can't lose weight. It won't go away. It's hormone. And it's not just the thyroid. People will do that. Like, oh, yeah, have you had your thyroid checked? Like you could see now, it's way more than just the thyroid. Yeah, I went to the doctor. He said the thyroid's fine. I don't know why. Right? Some people, it's blood sugar big time. It's like suddenly, boom, get the blood sugar balanced, get the thyroid, then the thyroid balances and the weight starts to come off. But it's for you, it's understanding how all this fits together so that you can then figure out for that person what it is, and you can help them. Insomnia, depression, skin lesions, high cholesterol. Not to say that the only cause is hormone imbalance, right? We're going to say, oh yeah, cancer is all hormone imbalance, but it's a contributing factor, okay? Skin lesions, well, maybe they just have an allergy to something, you know? But there's a lot of skin allergy. Gluten intolerance, for example. Gluten intolerance can cause a dermatitis herpetiformis, which is one kind of a skin lesion, and it can cause allergies to break out. It's a gluten intolerance. But why is gluten intolerant? Well, why are you gluten intolerant? It could be because your gut is all messed up and leaky. And why is your gut all messed up and leaky? Maybe because you're stressed out and you're constantly producing enzymes that shut down the digestive tract. So when the food goes in, you can't digest it. And then this food is undigested. Those particles get into the bloodstream and cause an allergy reaction. So anything you can think of can have its root in hormone imbalance. But again, we're not going to be, I'm an anti-dogma person. Does anybody know what dogma is? It's like a firm belief that this is it. This is the way it is. And I think dogma gets in our way. So we have food religions, and I have a whole module in my one of my courses that will go into food religions. And what? How do you pick it? Oh, what religion do I want to be this? The truth is, you may be having a few beliefs of this religion and a few beliefs of that religion. And I think there was a quote by Gandhi once, every religion has a piece of the truth. Okay? Every religion has a piece of the truth. Same thing with food religions. And what works for one isn't going to work for another, and that's why you can really help people to see. Okay? So let's talk about some of our assessment tools. I'm going to give you the overview of the assessment tools, get you really thinking about it, and then we'll dig in tomorrow, and we'll go through the book. I've got a lot of assessment tools in there, things that you can do. But the power of questions is amazing. I think it was, Tony Robbins, years ago. I listened to all the Tony Robbins stuff, really motivating and self-empowering and all, and it was the power of questions. He had a whole module on the power of questions. When you ask the right questions, you get the answers. And you can use it in your own life too, for yourself. When you ask empowering questions, you get useful answers that help you to get a solution going. When you ask disempowering questions, you just stay stuck in that model. So for example, if you are forgetful and you just keep forgetting your keys here and why do I keep forgetting things? That's a good question. So your brain's searching for all the reasons why you keep forgetting things. Because you're stupid, because you're careless, you don't pay attention, you're distracted, you're this, you're that. Is that empowering? No. You want to know, what can I do to help myself to stop forgetting and leaving things? What do I need to do differently? And that's the questions we need to ask our clients, because they have some of the answers in them. They have some of the answers in them. But beyond those questions, just whether it's empowering or disempowering, that's important. When you say to them, so what do you think is the most health-promoting thing you do in a week? Like, what's the best food you eat in a week? And they'll say, wow, yeah, I have peanut butter on whole wheat bread. That I think is the best thing I'm doing. Now you've got a basis to go, okay, their best food is peanut butter on whole wheat bread. You don't even have to ask them what their worst food is, right? You don't have to ask. You get some stuff to go on here because their concept of what healthy food is. And the other thing is, a lot of practitioners will say to their clients, so how's your digestion? And the client says, oh, it's good. Oh, good. Well, it's not a digestive problem. Oh, how's your sex drive? Well, it's okay. Okay, it's not a bad... Like, okay, you have to have much more quantifiable questions to ask people. Otherwise, the answers that you get, you're just going to skip something, right? I could have said to somebody, hey, yeah, so how's your blood sugar? Like, I guess it's fine. The doctor said it was fine on my last blood test, and I'm going to dispel your myths about blood sugar tomorrow when we have our chart. Oh, I guess it's fine. Doctor said it was fine. It was like, you know, 95. And if you say that after what we talk about with levels and stuff, you're going to go, 95, that's not good. That's pre-insulin resistance. That's not good, okay? And then what they're not telling you, too, is that, okay, that was first thing in the morning fasting.
What's your blood sugar after you ate those grapes or that Twinkie or whatever? How's your body reacting? And that's where we go to functional. Right? The typical doctor will look at a lab test as black or white. It's a state of the organs, right? It's either functional or dysfunctional. You have a pathology or you don't, right? What's in between? Pathology, no pathology. Shh. This is where we come in. This is where we are going to be able to assess function. And they can, on a blood test, I'm diverting a little bit, but on a blood test, you can have somebody test and say, oh, look, your liver enzymes are perfectly fine. They're right within the normal range. And they go back next year and they say that, and next year, and then suddenly they're high. If you go back and you look at a pattern, oh, the range goes up to 25, 10 to 25, and oh, they're at 14. Wow, they're really healthy. Well, they're at 16. They're still really healthy. Next year, they're at 18. They're still really healthy, but what's happening? It's going up. Don't you want to know in your clients and in yourself and your family members when things are trending towards disease and pathology versus when it's there? Like this woman, oh yeah, your blood sugar is 119. She goes, well, what does that mean? That seems high. And he said, yeah, it is high. It's pre-diabetic. She goes, great, what are we going to do about it? And he says, oh, come back in 6 months. It'll probably be in the diabetic range, and then I'll put you on medication. But his toolkit, right? We saw the toolkit before. He doesn't have the same tools in his toolkit. He wasn't taught those tools, or he's resistant to the tools. He was taught the drug, the pharmacy, you know, that's all he knows. That's all a lot of them know, and he or she. So not to fault them, it's just to say, hey, I want them in this class with me so I can teach them. Like the MD that came to my client assessment tools program, and she said, oh my God, I finally understand how this works. I'm like, I'm thinking that, because she was there, I'm like, she must know all more than I do about thyroid. She went to medical school for 4 years. She didn't know nothing about thyroid. And that's the case whenever I talk to practitioners, they'll be going, wow, how do you know so much? I had Jan, she's in the room, she went to her doctor, her family doctor, and was showing the lab test, and she goes, well, this is happening, this and this and that. And she's explaining all this stuff, and you know, I think I need this test. And he's like, where did you learn this stuff? And she told him that she had learned from me. Well, wow, she knows a lot. Okay? That's what you want your people to say about you. Like, wow, my doctor never told me that. My doctor never explained it to me that way. So questions. We're going to talk in depth about questions later and tomorrow. So what else? Oh, sorry. Besides the questions that you ask them, and I'm going to give you my three-page, it's already in your thing. It's a three-page short, like, initial kind of questionnaire that you can get so much insight from. We'll go through those questions tomorrow and tell you how to glean the insight that you'll know where to go from there. But beyond that, there's symptom surveys. So you've got those in your book, too. It's under a separate tab called assessments. And those symptom surveys will give you a score for each of your organs. Some of you have taken those because you've been in my programs. And we give those to people and we go, oh, your score of digestion is 50. Oh, it's 75. And it's not like school. It's the opposite of school. Because it means that you've got 75% of the symptoms that will predispose you to problems in this area. Woo, you don't want 75%. 10 or less, good. 75, not good. And there's ranges in between. And so you get a little score like red, green, blue, orange, etc. Okay, so those scorecards are invaluable. Now, do you have to give everybody like this big stack of questionnaires because they're going to run away? No, you do the little three-page, get to know them, and then you go, oh, I need to know more about their thyroid. Here's the thyroid thing. Let me find more about their digestion. And then you can go back easily and say, let's just see where your digestion's going. We've been working on this, and we've had you do this. Let's just see where it's at now. And you can give them, wow, look at that. You've improved this much. And let's talk about, wow, there's still some more improvement to go. Are you ready to do this next piece? And then you get them empowered. Go, wow, I've improved so much. Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Plus, if they have been doing a lot of stuff, I see this a lot, and they go in and you do these assessments and they find out all this stuff and they go on a program and then they don't come back and do another assessment. They come to another practitioner because they're not doing well, right? Because they did it for a little bit. I have people, I did this adrenal test. I say, great.
Well, and no, I don't want to do it again. I already did it. Well, how long ago did you do it? About 3 years. And what did they find? Oh, my adrenals are shot. Okay, good. What did they do about it? Oh, they gave me these drops to take and some other stuff. And oh, good. How long did you take it? And what did the follow-up test tell them? Follow-up test? I just figured I'd take them for 3 months and I'd be good and then I'd go about. Not good. I don't want you practicing that. And some of these are functional medicine practitioners that are doing this. Not the good ones, but I don't want you doing that. So if it's not going to be the expense of a lab test, why not have these? And tomorrow I'm going to show you a physical exam that you can either do on your clients if you have that, if that's within your scope of practice to be able to do, like your nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. But if it's not, then you get them to do it on themselves. It's really cool. And so there's some functional things that you can be looking at to reassess how's your adrenals going without having to spend the money on the adrenal test, and then you do the adrenal test later down the road. It's very cool. So assessments are really critical. Physical exam, I just mentioned that. There's so many things. You go into a doctor and you do this exam and okay, everything's fine. Nope, no tumors. You're good. Everything's fine. That's not a functional assessment. We're going to look at a nutritionally oriented functional assessment. And there's all these subtle signs that things can be going wrong. Their nails, their hair, their skin. There's all kinds of things. So it's really important to know those things. And blood chemistry, like we talked about earlier, that typical, oh, everything's fine. You're either almost dead or you're good. And they do that with adrenals. It's like, adrenals? Oh, yeah, Addison's or healthy. You're either one of the spectrums. Whoa, we know that there's a whole lot more in between. And then there's the functional assessments. And while we won't go into the details of how to analyze each of these tests, because I have a whole 6-month course that goes through that, but I'm going to introduce you to these tests and share with you what kind of conditions or what kind of presentation they would have that would warrant it. Personally, I am not a big fan of just loading somebody up with a whole bunch of functional tests right at the beginning. Somebody comes in and they're eating M&Ms and eating at McDonald's and smoking cigarettes. I'm going to run a functional battery of tests. Of course it's going to be all out of whack. Why waste their money or time? Unless they have unlimited funds and they say, well, I'm only going to change if you prove it to me that I need to. Then you do it. But for the most part, you can get away with just doing a diet history and understanding how all these things go and start to balance them and then say, look, we've gotten to this point. Let's do a functional test now because we want to fine-tune this and see what's going on. And for some people, you won't do any of these tests. You know, besides the blood chem, I like to see everybody do because it's a real easy, inexpensive. Direct Labs does it for $97, except in December they do it for $59. So really inexpensive. It's a $450 test if you went through a lab, regular medical. So it gives people a lot of information, and if you know how to analyze it, then you can be on the forefront of saying, oh, it looks like you have a zinc deficiency. I'm like, how did you find that? You didn't measure zinc. Oh, well, zinc is and I know that, and I know how it works, and it's really cool. And let's see, where are we at? Fatty acids. Oh, adrenal, some of the functional assessments. Adrenal, that's a saliva test. We'll go through more details tomorrow. Fatty acids, where you can actually tell, because fats are super important, right? Who thinks that fat is an evil thing and we should avoid it? Good. Fat's not evil. We need fat, but we need to know we have the balance, and there's tests you can do. Amino acids, those are the building blocks of protein. Somebody's having a lot of hormonal problems and you're having a hard time figuring out why. It could be that they're low in specific amino acids that are used to make the hormones, or a neurotransmitter problem, right? They don't have a Prozac deficiency, they have a tyrosine deficiency, right? It's a lot easier to fix. There's no such thing as a Prozac deficiency, just for the record. So I don't want anybody to think I think there's a Prozac deficiency. But yeah, so we're going to look at that. Organic acids are really cool. I don't do that in everybody. In the people I do, it's really when it's very, very severe cases and we're not making progress and we want to see. Because organic acids are metabolic intermediates that help you to see. Say this particular chemical gets converted and should be excreted as this chemical, but you've got a buildup of an intermediate. Ah, what are the nutrients? What are the cofactors? What are the factors that body needs to go further down? An example of that is something called methylmalonic acid. So people will say B12 deficiency, they'll measure the blood and say you don't have a B12 deficiency. That's not a functional test. That's a level test. That doesn't mean that you have enough B12 to do all the functions you need. So you measure the urinary methylmalonic acid. And that should be minuscule in the urine. If it's elevated, it means that your B12 is you don't have enough B12 because B12 is required for it to convert it from the precursor down to it. And you're getting a buildup of methylmalonic acid. That can be contributing to the symptoms that B12 deficiency can cause, which are a lot of neurological type symptoms. So we want you to be understanding all this. Not by the end of the weekend. You're not going to know all of this by the end of the weekend, but you're going to have enough to go on, and you're definitely going to be really comfortable with the questions and the surveys and that physical exam form. You can just take that away and use it right away. And you can take it and modify it and say, oh, I'm not going to have them do this, and do a subset of it, a shortened. I have a very comprehensive one. But you can use these things right away. You can take these assessments and just start working with people that, oh, I suspect that maybe their metabolic rate hormones are out of balance, or I suspect you can take that and use it. And if you have those really effective people, the really excited people, you can give them all. Say, I can give you scorecards of all your systems. Okay? And then the last one is minerals and hormone panels. When we look at the hormones, the steroid hormone pathway, you see there's ways to test that. But again, it's a $400 or $500 test. So I'm not running that on everybody. I'm running that on certain people. We're going to do as much as we can to functionally assess. But you want to know when you need to use these things. You want to know what's available when you're stuck. Oh, okay. That was the end of the morning. Are we there? No. Okay. Let's open for questions right now, and then we'll just keep going, because I think I may have backloaded or up front loaded or backloaded it. Yeah. So the way questions will work is we need a mic runner, and then she'll come up. Just stand up. You can just face me since it's a question for me, and yeah, up here. And then Gretchen will know who to give the mic to.
You don't have to answer this now. I just wondered if you're going to touch on client compliance. So, you know, it's great to go through and do all these things with people, but how do you get them? I mean, yes, you get them to stay by making changes right away, but that doesn't always, sometimes it's a slower process. So
Right.
I would love to know how you get around that. Are you going to be talking?
I will be. Okay. And in fact, I have a process that you're going to get. You're going to sheet, a worksheet that says, here's my system for doing it. And there's some things you have to do right at the beginning and throughout to help just reinforce for them that how important it is for them.
Do you do,
and what's in it for them.
Do you package it up or for people, or do you do... have them pay. You'll talk about it.
Talk about that. Right. Yes, you mean in terms of programs? Yeah, definitely packaging them up, because when you do this one-off kind of appointment, oh, come see me. Oh, come back in a week.
They don't come. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'll wait another week because it's going to cost me more money, and then they're losing it. I've had people come back like three or four months later, and I've told them to come back in a week. This was years ago because I don't do that anymore, and they'll say, "Oh, well, I've been doing what you told me, but nothing's working." I'm like, "Oh, we were supposed to have you come back in a week, and I didn't want you to continue. We were going to test that to see if you needed to do something different." And I'll say, "Well, so what are you doing? Well, are you doing this? Are you doing no? I'm not doing that. Are you doing this?" How could you expect? And so I finally said no, because I would have somebody who would come in every 6 months and she'd redo labs, and I hadn't seen her for 6 months, so I had seen lots and lots of people in between, so I'm trying to remember what were her problems, because I don't see her, talk to her every week. And it would take me an hour and a half to go through all her labs and all her charts and see what I'd recommended for her before the visit. Now, if she was willing to pay me for 3 hours of my time instead of the hour that she booked with me, but that's psychologically, people are like, oh, I spent an hour with you and you're charging me $1,000 or, you know, something, whatever it is. They don't get all the work you're doing behind the scenes. So when you're creating a package, you need to build that in. So if your package includes, they do all the assessments, you analyze the assessments, and then you have a visit with them to explain it and to set up a plan, you have to calculate the hours that you're going to spend behind the scenes on that. And so I'll just give you a little sneak ahead on that. When you package it up, you always want to include things that they can't value, because they go, wow, she's going to spend this much time with me and she's charging me that much an hour, because they don't know the behind the scenes and all that, and they feel outraged because they make $10 an hour, you know, as a clerk. So in order to avoid that, you package in, oh, and you're going to get a recipe guide and you're going to get a video and you're going to get, you know, whatever. You just package it all together, and then they go, wow, that's a really good deal, right? But if I tell somebody, yeah, you can come see me and it's, you know, we're going to have 4 hours of my time and the package costs $1,000, they're like, Wow, you make $250 an hour? Wow, I want your job, right? But then they don't know what else goes on behind the scenes. And you do deserve to be paid for what you do, right? Because the research, just the expense of coming here, you have to factor that into your rates as well. The expense that you go through to learn this stuff to be able to give it back to them, and then all the research you're doing behind the scenes. And what you'll find, and I still do this, is if I have a tough case and it's beyond what I've done before, you're reading and researching. Because you don't want to be the MD that goes, oh, I don't know what that is to you, just take Prozac. And we'll hope for the best, right? You don't want to be that kind of practitioner. I know you don't, or you wouldn't be here. You want to dig. So you may, for every person, and you can't really necessarily charge for, like, one person for the 8 hours of research that you had to do, because you're going to use that for the next and the next and the next that has that. But your fees should be reflective of that amount of time, right? And it's really cool that you learn that way. Every time, I bless it now. Anytime something comes across my door that is challenging and I haven't seen before, okay, it's a new thing for me to figure out, right? And when you have the basics and you know how that body works and how it all fits together, you can be good. You're real good, okay? Another question. Over here, Gretchen. And remind me your name here. Megan, right. I'll get you names after a while.
I just have a quick question about the assessments.
Yes.
So you were talking about the one that's $97, and it's kind of the full, I forget who, is it diagnostics?
Oh, yeah, the blood chemistry.
Blood chemistry. So were you saying that is part of your functional assessments? I know you have a program with that. Or are you going to teach us in this weekend how to analyze that if we have someone go over it? So you were saying, like, oh, if you're zinc deficient, you can figure it out by...
That would be like a whole weekend workshop in and of itself to go through all the details of that.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're not going to go through, per se, that test. I'll show you some tomorrow when we do assessments. Mm-hmm. Now, like, I'll show you the adrenal thing. Like, an adrenal stress test, I could teach you in 15 minutes how to do a basic overview of it. But with this... And what we're planning to do is give you a spreadsheet that you can have after the fact. I'm going to try to figure out how I can get it up on the screen. I should be able to. Okay. To show you some of those lines in it and where you would fill it in, and then what the interpretation is. So I've it's basically a spreadsheet that I put together. And it's got, like, so say one of the things is AST, which is one of the liver enzymes. And there's a range, and there's a functional range and a pathological range. And then over on the other side, you're going to see something that says, oh, if it's low, look at this. It might be this. If it's high, look at this. And that's a questionnaire, and I'll share that with you. But the actual going through that is part of my client assessment tools, and we spent a whole day on just that one piece.
Okay.
And then we still didn't get it all, because it's, right? But you have a tool, right?
Sure.
You have a tool, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, over here? She's going to come around. They're good questions. And remember your name again.
Eleanor Lotger.
Oh, Eleanor, yes. Hi Eleanor.
Hi. You mentioned that one of the hormones was a steroid hormone, which may led me to believe that there must be categories of hormones and families of hormones. Can you just explain what that is? Because it just went over my head.
Okay, great. Good question. Yes. There's a category of hormones called the steroids, and we'll show you a chart of that this afternoon. And the steroid hormones are... basically, the building blocks, so there's a steroid ring, and they're very similar, right? So it's a category of hormones called the steroids. So in that hormone category is cortisol, progesterone, estrogen, DHEA, testosterone. And to go from one hormone to the next is one metabolic reaction. And I'll show you the chart. I think it's a few ahead. Let me just see if I can find it. No. Yeah, it'll be too hard to find it again. But it's further out, and if you look in your notes in there. So that's the category called steroid hormones, right? They're all precursors of each other. Are there other categories necessarily? They're mostly peptides,
right? So for example, thyroid is tyrosine, an amino acid, with iodine, right? So the adrenal hormones are all in that steroid. There's catecholamines, which are hormone neurotransmitter combinations. So that's where you've got your adrenaline and norepinephrine. Those are hormones, but they're also neurotransmitters. So you've got your neurotransmitter category of hormones. You've got that. You've also got things like leukotrienes and things like that, which are hormone-like things that control your inflammation. Okay, so there's not like families per se, like I could say there's five categories, because they're, it just has to do with their chemical structure. So the steroids are its particular steroid chemical structure. The neurotransmitter ones are related to specific neurotransmitters. Thyroid's category in of itself, tyrosine and iodine. Okay, does that answer your question? Okay, kind of. Is there more? Okay.
Sounds like there's different chemical structure of different hormones, which kind of lead them to do different things.
Things, right. Okay, good. Right. And there's some of them can be interconverted between. So the thyroid category of hormones, there's the thyroxine, which is T4, which is what the thyroid produces. And then it gets converted to T3. A little bit of T3 is produced by the thyroid, but not. And T4 means four iodines with the tyrosine. T3 means three iodines with the tyrosine. There's also what nobody else talks about, but it's DIT, diiodotyrosine, which is, it's triiodo is three. It's two. It's not an active hormone, but it's an intermediate in the production. Okay, so there, it's a complex, we'll have a picture of them later so you can see. But the thyroid hormones, so then you have reverse T3, which is you can take the T4 and you can go to T3 or it can go to reverse T3. See, so there's just different ways that they manipulate in between each other. Make sense? Okay, and we have over here. Which way? She's right in the middle, so hard to tell.
Hi, I'm Delisa Renadeo from Alaska.
Delisa, yes.
And if I know you already explained the part about the neurotransmitters and like the dopamine, and I was wondering if you could explain it again. Here's my confusion. It sounded like what you were saying was that it was produced in a nerve, and then it's transmitted to another nerve, and then it goes into the blood where it becomes a hormone. But that doesn't make sense to me. Mm. Okay.
Let's draw.
Okay.
There's different places where hormones can originate from, okay? So if you've got, I'm not a good artist this way. Let's just say these are nerves. They look like humeruses or something, but nerves. And this nerve wants to tell this nerve, hey, we're sending the signal of relaxing that muscle over there. It produces, it squirts out into this is called the synapse. Yep, and you got the constituents of it. It's made there, and then it's released. These little vesicles, and it gets released in the nerve out here. So it may be dopamine, serotonin, acetylcholine, GABA. There's a whole bunch of them. And they get secreted and squirted. Now, this guy has, what do you think it has? Receptors! And goes in and gets transmitted, and it says, oh, we're sending an inhibitory signal to the bicep muscle. Boom, sends it down, and it passes it on. Fortunately, it's not like the game of telephone that we played when we were kids most of the time, right? The signal that starts here usually makes its way down, but there can be things that interrupt it, right? There can be toxins in the system, the vessel can get confused, or it can be damage to one of the nerves. So, but most of the time, it's making it down. When it's not, then you might see people with weird neurologic symptoms, right? It could be, there are various things that interfere with that. Now, so dopamine and serotonin are good examples of, they can get into the bloodstream. Well, can they get into the bloodstream here? Well, sure, there's some interstitial space which can get absorbed into the bloodstream, but also there are other places where dopamine and serotonin can be produced. Okay, and some of it is in actually the epithelial cells, the lining cells of the intestinal tract, and they can produce dopamine and serotonin. But if there's a lot of dopamine or serotonin or deficiency of serotonin, then what you can have is problems in your gut. Or if you have additional, so say, I'll just give you a little extra head start here. 5-HTP, does anybody not know what that is? Okay, it is a piece of an amino acid. So this is 5-hydroxytryptophan. Tryptophan is an amino acid, one of the essential amino acids. 5-hydroxy just has to do with chemically, it has a hydroxy group added to it. So 5-HTP. And it's actually a precursor to serotonin. So it's tryptophan, 5-hydroxytryptophan down to serotonin. And years ago, back in, I think it was the 60s or 70s, 80s, I think it was the 80s, when Prozac first came on the market, people were saying, well, we can do tryptophan. And it was working just as well as, so, but they took it off the market because there was a contaminated batch and there was a lot of hoopla that kept it off the market longer than it needed to because Tylenol had contaminated batches and it's back on the market. It got back on the market pretty quickly. But there were reasons, drug lobbies, et cetera, just my belief, drug lobbies, et cetera, that said, wow, but that's going to interfere with the sales of Prozac. So at this point, the sales of Prozac went through the roof because people that were using tryptophan couldn't get it anymore. So basically, they said, well, tryptophan is illegal, but we can do 5-hydroxytryptophan. So it's a version of tryptophan that supplement companies were able to make. Well, it turns out that it's actually more effective than the tryptophan itself for most people. So you make serotonin, but if you put somebody on 5-HTP, and I usually do it with B vitamins because you need B6 is the most important one to be able to convert it. That's what's called a coenzyme, a cofactor for the enzyme. So an enzyme converts substances, chemicals in your system, right? So one chemical to another, you need an enzyme to convert. You also have coenzymes, and those are usually nutrients. So that's why nutrients are so, so important, right? If nutrient imbalances can cause so many things because they cause a deficiency of the activity of certain enzymes, and that pathway gets blocked. And that's why you can open things up. Like how many people have had a situation where they've either themselves or somebody just taken a specific vitamin and had like, oh my God, it's like everything was fixed. It was because you identified that particular cofactor that was getting in the way. So whenever I'm working with somebody who's depressed and I assume they have a serotonin, and you'll see in your assessments a way to kind of differentiate between different neurotransmitter imbalances, that the serotonin then will increase when you increase the 5-HTP and the B6. But what happens is, and you know the thing is working, if you go too fast at bringing that up, they'll end up with like, oh, I'm running to the bathroom all the time. Oh, my gut is all, because it increases the motility in the gut because it's stimulating the activity down there. Okay, 80%, 60 to 80%, I don't remember the exact number, 60 to 80% of all serotonin in the system is not in the brain. It's in the gut. Okay, dopamine is a little bit less, right? So there's these interconnections and in how you can affect things. So if you give somebody a supplement or make a recommendation and you see they get a result that you're going, oh, what the heck is that all about? Go to the chemistry. When you go to the chemistry, you understand it. Somebody says, oh, this drug worked really well for me, but I don't want to take it. I'm going to study the chemistry of that. I want to see what are the constituents that go in there, or if they had a particular hormonal issue. I will go through and say, oh, that's why. Well, why don't we manipulate that pathway this way? And just a quick aside, just because somebody's bound to ask it later, SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. It's a class of drugs. Prozac is one, Paxil is one, Zoloft. They're SSRIs. So when you get the dopamine or serotonin into that, what's called the synapse, and then they get picked up, not all of it's going to get picked up by the receptors. So it gets broken down, and then it gets taken up again.
okay? Instead of getting it taken up again, those drugs prevent the reuptake. So if you produce a bunch of serotonin and it's in the space and you take an SSRI, it allows you to continue to use the serotonin over and over again. It's actually, it gets signals, it does the signal and then the materials are in the synapse. So what happens is if somebody has a deficiency and you put them on an SSRI, a reuptake inhibitor, you're not fixing the deficiency. You're just, it's like an air. Like if you went into a room and you said, we have a deficiency of oxygen or air in this room. So instead of letting the air blow out the window, we're going to blow it back in. After a while, right, there's no more oxygen left in there because the oxygen, every time it gets recycled, plus you're getting sicker and sicker because you're not breathing pure air. So that's similar with this. So what you find is when somebody comes in and says, I've been on this SSRI, it worked great when I first went on it, and now it doesn't work so well. It's because they've depleted themselves even further. But what is this doing, this functional approach, is giving them the materials they need to replenish their deficiency. Do they have to do it forever? Generally not. It just depends, right? And what I've done with people that wanted to get off of it, I'll say, look, you can't just stop an SSRI or antidepressant and really make sure you're aware of that. If somebody says, I want to get off my antidepressant, don't let them. Tell them not to. You've got to work with your doctor because you've got to wean slowly because the rebound depression that can happen is awful. So, but you can decrease the level. Well, first what you would do is add some extra support, right? But a little bit, not the full dose. You wouldn't give them like the full dose of 5-HTP or B6 that you would give them if they weren't on anything and they just wanted to not take Prozac and they're depressed. But you give them a little bit, and you see how they do. And then you tell them to talk to their doctor about decreasing it a little bit. I did this once with my sister, and she didn't work with her doctor, but she wasn't going to sue me. So so she was on Prozac. She hadn't been on that long. She'd only been on for a few months. And she wanted to get off of it. So we had her start with the 5-HTP for a couple of days at a very low dose. And then I said, okay, after a while, she says, she basically told me, okay, I'm just going to have this every other day. I said, well, that's too fast. I said, but what you can do is have it in the morning of, say, Tuesday, and then take your next dose in the afternoon on Wednesday. So you're going a day and a half. You're not cutting it in half. She was, oh, okay, I could do that. And sometimes you can get them to cut their pills or whatever. So she basically did that, and then she increased the 5-HTP and decreased. So she went faster than I would have recommended, but it worked. And she got off of it completely. So it can happen, but do not ever try to do this on your own, right? You work with a doctor that is prescribed the medication or refer them to somebody who does both. Okay, that's like an aside from that, but I thought it was important to mention that neurotransmitters, hormones, it's similar with hormones. If somebody's on some hormone replacement and they want to get off of it, if you just take them off of it, the body goes into that rebound. So you support them. And the other thing I will say about hormone replacement is that there's safe ways to do it and unsafe ways to do it. So using hormones from an animal that's not a human, in a human, not a good thing. It's not bioidentical. It's not the same. Using synthetics, like people say, oh, don't take progesterone, it can cause this and that and the other thing. Progestins are problematic. Progestins are a synthetic form of progesterone that the drug company thinks, oh, it's similar, we're just going to sell it as progesterone. It's not progesterone, and it actually has some of the opposite effects. It can do some of the same things, but it's a problem. But if you take somebody off rapidly, off their stuff, they're going to go through rebound. So you're supporting it. But really, when we're working with hormones and you have people who are on bioidenticals, the very first thing you could do is put them on a supportive diet that's going to help them when they convert. We'll talk about this in the afternoon in the conversion sheet, but when they convert to be able to do it in a way that is going to the safe metabolites versus the unsafe metabolites. And that's what that whole BRCA gene thing I put up before. It's how do we promote the metabolism of that hormone to go safe versus unsafe. So if somebody comes in and they're on all kinds of stuff and you're on, how can I support them initially? Because I'm not going to tell them to go off of their stuff. You support them with the foods, and I have a chart in the afternoon that shows estrogen and all the ways that you can keep it safe. Okay. So if there's, how are we doing on time? There's no other question. We were supposed to go till 12:30. There's no other questions. We We have 15? So, oh, five. Oh, we're supposed to go to 12:15. Okay, good. Good. So we'll just pick this up in the afternoon. And I have a lot of really, what do you call them? Elaborate types of flowcharts. And you'll have them. They're small in here because we didn't want to kill trees. But you basically, you'll have the big version of it. And they're really cool when you understand the metabolism of how this works and how nutrition plays in. Like the estrogen, I love the estrogen chart because it just shows all the places where you can keep estrogen safe versus unsafe. Okay? Okay. Laura has a, let me introduce Laura. Laura has a form that she's going to pass out. She's doing a class tonight on the more softer stuff, right? The stuff you need in terms of the interview skills and being able to work with people. And she has just a little thing. She's trying to get an idea of what people most need. So if you could fill that out and you want it back, where can they just, you'll be around, or should they just turn them in after lunch and we'll collect them and give them to you? Okay. Yeah, so if over lunch, if you could just take a couple of minutes to fill that out, then just pass it back to us. We'll collect them after the break, after the lunch break. And then she'll be able to really target in on that tonight. She did some stuff with me when I met her in California about a month ago. And she just started doing this stuff with, okay, so let's pretend you're the client, I'm the person. And she just started saying stuff, which is very typical of what, and now we're going to work on it. And I'm like, she goes, yeah, see that? See what you just did? Okay, I'm going to teach them how to read the energy of people, and whether it's your clients or your mother. Right? All of us say, well, my mother doesn't listen to me, my husband doesn't listen to me, my clients listen to me better. Maybe the way that we're interacting and the way we're speaking and the energy in that relationship that's causing that. And if we can learn some of these subtle techniques to do the energy differently, that goes back to your question about compliance. How do we get the compliance? So some of what Laura's going to teach us this evening is going to help us with that question about compliance. Okay, so we're good.